The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Heaven's own precious child, a person full of worth and dignity. When her beauty is defiled, I demean.
Our conversation with Steve Siller, who is, by the way, the executive producer of the highlight of the tune you just heard a moment ago, Somebody's Daughter. We're talking about the impact of pornography and the challenges that we face in trying to bring balance to this topic. I mean, it was challenging 30, 40, 50 years ago with the advent of certain publications out there, you know, the Hugh Hefners of the world, Larry Flint's and those. Now, with the advent of the World Wide Web, it's impossible to control it. And as Steve points out, parents face the fact your children, like it or not, will be exposed to pornography. The question is, how will they react to it? Will they see it? Will they balance biblical perspective? And toward that end, is it problematic and challenging, particularly for young people, Steve, because as much as parents in the church and those in the know are trying to warn kids about the impact of all of this, that it's not just something that's ooh, nasty, but it can create false intimacy that later on can damage the ability to carry on a normal relationship with a spouse. But then, too, that notion that we're trying to combat something here with so many mixed messages in the general public, that I imagine a lot of teenagers look at this and say, well, wait a minute. You know, if it's so bad and so terrible, how come it's so pervasive?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, one of the things that I think we have to do, and as Christian parents, as parents in general, it's not easy. Because, I mean, you know, we've all heard about the talk, right? Ever since we were kids.
Oh, yes, the talk.
The point is, I think one of the first things we can do for our kids, you know, we always tell our kids at church the truth will set them free. Then we don't tell about the truth that they're living through. And I think what we need to say to them is, look, it's natural to have curiosity about sex. God created sex. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It is exciting. But you want to experience it in the proper context and with a proper understanding of its power. So toward that end, let me share with you why pornography is not the proper way to experience sex. But I think that starting point is admitting, yeah, this is exciting. This gets you worked up. And I think, I know kids hate to be manipulated. Whenever I talk to high school kids and even college kids, I always tell them, don't you realize the pornographers are manipulating your natural hormones to their financial advantage? They don't care about you. They don't care whether this is going to ruin your ability to have intimacy. They don't care whether it's going to mess up your relationship with your girlfriend. They don't care about any of that. They just want to get you hooked when you're young so they'll have a customer for life. And I think when kids realize that, they can get a little angry, and that's when I think they have a chance against this stuff, when they value themselves enough to say, you know what, I'm not going to be tricked into spending, you know, ruining my intimacy and spending and my worth and my value, throwing it away on this stuff.
The talk. How soon should we begin the talk? How educated do parents need to get ahead of it? You know, and I know that sounds like an odd question. It's like, I'm your parent. Of course I understand how the birds and the bees work. If I didn't, you wouldn't be here.
Well,
it's changed so drastically. Steve, even from when I was a kid, and I'm certainly no kid, but I'm no fossil either. It's changed so dramatically to try to be able to understand and relate to these kids as they're dealing with the barrage of not just the internet, but but now cell phones and texting and sexting mm-hmm. and all this, too.
Well, I think, yes, parents have to be educated. In fact, there's a number of things I want to say about this. I have something I've created called the Things You Can Do list, and I want to make sure everybody knows how to get it because it's free. It's at our website. One of the things that I encourage parents to do is get educated, and I encourage churches to have ongoing parental education in this area, because the technology that was the coolest 6 months ago, you know how that goes. It's out of date already. I mean, kids are able to access this stuff through ways that most parents don't even realize, like through a Wii. You know, I mean, it's crazy what the technology can do, and our kids fly this stuff like jet planes because they've been on the technology since they were little. Whereas, you know, folks like us, I mean, we've come to it later in life, so we don't even really understand how quickly and how pervasively this stuff can move around. So, yes, education is important, but I think as far as having the talk early, you know, we have to understand kids are seeing this stuff. The average age of exposure now to pornography, I've heard as low as 8. The oldest age I've heard in the last year is 11 on average. You know, I wish we could afford to wait till later, because, you know, we all hate this idea of ruining our kids' innocence. But, you know, a dear friend of mine, his 6-year-old was doing a little homework assignment and came across something hardcore. So, you know, and I've heard that story more than once. So I just really, you know, want to encourage people. Obviously, you need to do things age appropriately, but I want to encourage people not to shy away from beginning to have these discussions in a way that will give their kids some guardrails. And as far as technology goes, I mean, parents need to understand, you know, you need to have all kinds of internet accountability, internet filter software on all your computers, the blocking software. You need to have it on your phones. You need to have it on your televisions. You need to have every computer in the house and pass through rooms. My son is 17. He still doesn't have a computer or a TV in his room, and he feels Amish. That's too bad. You know, that's just too bad. You know, that said, our kids are going to go out into the world. You got to know your parents' friends. You got to talk about this stuff. It isn't any fun. Like you said, I wish it wasn't true, but it is. We got to talk about this stuff because we can't. I put it this way. The church wants to be a light in the world. We can't be a light in the world till we mentor our own kids. We can't mentor our own kids until we admit that as adults we struggle with it. We need to come clean and get healthy, and we can't do any of that until we just start talking about it. So for me, somebody's daughter is that light switch that can be turned on in a church. Start the conversation. And once you do that, there's all sorts of things you can do.
Some good insights from Steve Siller, again, executive producer of Somebody's Daughter. Steve, finally, if folks touched by this song would like to get a copy of it, is it available through iTunes or how?
The DVD's on iTunes. The DVD CD set is at our website. They can go to somebodysdaughter.org. And they can also, to get the 3 things you can do list, they can go to musicforthesoul.org. On the homepage, click on pornography, and it'll take you to a page with all sorts of free resources. And I really encourage them to get the Things You Can Do list from our page, print it out, take it to their church, read through it, and find some things that you can begin to do, things you can do personally, things you can do in your family, in your church, and in your community at large to make a difference. Because if we all get involved and start taking a piece of this, we can turn this tide. I really believe we can.
Indeed so. Steve Siller, thanks so much for the time. And again, on the web, somebodysdaughter.org or musicforthesoul.org.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Over the course of conversation with a colleague of mine, he was talking about a series of photographs, a collage really, floating about on Facebook. One side to the left depicts photographs of the likes of Albert Einstein, Carl Sandburg, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, Arturo Toscanini, a good Irish name for you. And on the left, a photograph of Snooki from Jersey Shore. By the way, if you don't know who that is, congratulate yourself. The caption below this collage of photograph reads, "If you know the person on the right, but none on the left, you might be what's wrong with America." And that, I think, is an ideal introduction to my next guest on the program tonight. He is the author of a number of best-selling books, including Intellectual Morons and A Conservative History of the American Left. His latest book is entitled Blue Collar Intellectuals, When the Enlightened and the Everyman Elevated America. We're joined tonight by Daniel Flynn. Daniel, as we mentioned, in addition to being a best-selling author, is also a columnist for humanevents.com and a blogger at flynnfiles.com. And Daniel, thanks so much for being with us on the program tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I thought that the story of that collage of photographs, I don't know what, but maybe you have seen them, in many ways kind of defines exactly what has happened in this slow but steady slide into the abyss in America today, where even as we've tried to search for some sort of a connection between the intellectuals and the so-called inspiration for the Occupy Wall Street movement, there is scant little evidence of same.
Yeah, I haven't seen those pictures, but you did what a good radio host will do, which is to create a visual with your words. So I feel like I've seen those pictures, and I've certainly seen Snooki and those other characters as well. But that's kind of where we're at as a culture, where you know it used to be the case around the mid-century mark that the United States of America is, you know, the people of the United States of America were the best, you know, the most well-educated people in the history of the world. You had University of the Air-style radio programs, the Book of the Month Club, great books, discussion groups, meeting in YMCAs and union halls around the country. You don't see that very much today. And I think part of the reason is that the everyman is, you know, rather than reaching for something higher, they're kind of dragging their arms ever lower, you know, for Snooki and the situation and all that kind of thing. But on the other side of the coin, you don't have intellectuals as eager to engage the everyman. And we once had intellectuals, you know, the blue collar intellectuals that I write about, who spoke not just to other eggheads, but were very enthusiastic about opening up a conversation to all comers. And I think the issue we have today, sure, part of it's you know, Joe Sixpack not being as intellectually curious as he once was, but the other part of it is that you have you know, academics who are operating in an intellectual ghetto.
And let's face it, there needs to be some source of stimulation to encourage that intellectual curiosity. And I think, as you aptly point out throughout your new book, Blue Collar Intellectuals, I mean, part of this we can lay squarely at the feet of, you know, reality shows, which are anything but, you know, video games as entertainment. Facebook is our singular means by which we stay socially connected. I imagine what a shock it would be for our great-great-grandparents who communicated either in person, faccia a faccia, as we would say in Italian, or by the old-fashioned method of handwriting letters, and now all of a sudden it's been reduced down to anything that you can get in 140 characters on Twitter, and this all of a sudden has now been the substitute for social interaction. I mean, I think we can point at a number of levels of the steady decline, if not outright decay, of not only our social interaction skills, but our intellectual skills as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I was out in your neck of the woods researching this book, and something that you said really brought to mind some of my research in the archives, looking at people like Eric Hoffer at the Hoover Institution, or Milton Friedman and Hoffer having some papers also at the San Francisco Public Library. And when you research archives of people who lived, you know, 50, 100 years ago, you grasp how even just normal people, how good they were at writing. And they wrote letters. They wrote long letters to people. And I wonder what's going to happen 50 or 100 years from now when people look at our writing. I don't know if they're going to be saving Twitter tweets or saving text messages, but I shudder to think at how they will look at us from the way we write, because we're not really impressing people with that.
Well, and you point out in the book, and I saw this, and there was a resounding knee-slapping amen, brother, when I read this line inside of the book, this notion that, you know, for the longest time we used to decry the kind of trash that showed up at the grocery store checkout line, you know, which was everything from, you know, the world's weird news to the National Enquirer, et cetera, et cetera. Now, all of a sudden today, it is hard to differentiate differentiate between what you see at the grocery checkout stand and what you see at the newsstand these days. And even, you know, even with the internet and the ability of it to bring to us such a vast knowledge of the collected, you know, awareness and understanding of the world right there at the fingertips of the keyboard. It seems as if even so-called legitimate news sites can't deal somehow with the abstraction to the outright obsession of things like, you know, focusing on no talent, nobodies like a Kim Kardashian. All of this, sure. I think, just, you know, indicative, as you pointed out, you know, when the newsstand is no different than the checkout line at the grocery store, you know, it might be subtle, but I think it's a very profound subtlety as to what it says about who we have become as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, the book is really about a time when smart looked for you. And I think what you have today is, you know, you can still look for, you can still find smart if you look hard enough, but it's smart's not really looking for you. In other words, there's sort of an invasive stupidity. There is, you know, I travel a lot in writing books, and I get into the back of a cab, and all of a sudden, I don't know when this started, but there's a TV that I can't turn off in the back of a cab. You sit in an airport waiting room. There's no escape from you know, the CNN International blaring in the background. You can't find a quiet corner to read. Even when you get on the subway, it used to be, if you'd notice, you know, when you ride the subway, people would be reading. They'd be reading newspapers and magazines and books. And now, I mean, there's still some people who are reading, but most of the time people are texting, they're playing a video game, they're doing something with an electronic gadget. And I can't help but think, from observing all this, how we spend our leisure time, it's largely become a waste of time. And, you know, far be it for me to lecture someone, hey, you have to use your time in the way that I want you to use your time. That's not what I'm trying to do. But I can't help but thinking that the way we use our leisure time is really affecting us in a negative way as a country.
You're right. And as you point out, you know, for the working man, the blue-collar guy that worked in industry back in the 1930s and 40s, say, or who had migrated to states like California during the Dust Bowl period in Oklahoma, you know, by no stretch of the imagination were these educated people or necessarily highbrow or intellectuals. And yet, as you say, there was enough in popular culture and enough influence by the so-called intellectuals that went looking for the common man or the blue-collar guy to help try and elevate him. I mean, my goodness, it's not that many years ago that things like, you know, Campbell's Playhouse would present Shakespearean plays in their entirety over the course of several evenings, or the Firestein Theater with great orchestras and great opera. And this would be prime-time television, 8 o'clock at night on a Wednesday evening, and the entire family sat down and watched this and learned, and they got exposed to some culture, and they had a little bit of, you know, the intellectual exercise going on. All of that has disappeared.
Sure, and, you know, I think about the first blue-collar intellectual that I write about, a guy named Will Durant, and, I, you know, one of the reasons why I think these blue-collar intellectuals had, and, you know, felt an obligation to engage the everyman is because they came from, you know, the mass of Americans that were not at the top, but were, you know, somewhere in the scrum there. And Will Durant, I mean, this is an amazing Only in America story. His father was illiterate. I mean, Will Durant wrote the best-selling philosophy book in the 20th century, The Story of Philosophy. Outsold Charles Lindbergh's autobiography after he flew over the Atlantic. I mean, that's how much people were eager to read his book. Will Durant, along with Ariel Durant, his wife, wrote some of, you know, books that were perennially on the bestseller list, a history of the world, which he called The Story of Civilization, 11-volume set over the course of 45 years from the 1920s all the way up through the 1970s. His dad couldn't speak a lick of English. He had 10 kids, and he worked in a factory. And when we talk about the American dream, we're so transfixed on the monetary angle. And certainly there are these rags-to-riches Horatio Alger stories. But the striver culture that I'm talking about in blue-collar intellectuals also had to do with an educational betterment. And I think the story of a guy like Will Durant exemplified that. And I think the fact that we don't see that as much anymore.
Well, and we've dumbed down democracy in every sense of the word. And unfortunately, education, whether we're talking about Main Street, K through 12, on up to even the higher levels of education, has seen this huge paradigm shift from teaching people how to think, presenting the facts, and then allowing them to draw their own conclusions, to the easy way out, simply what to think, where we can regurgitate a couple of details here and there that tends to sort of just make up a particular political opinion or political thrust, and end of story. And this, I think, is demonstrating, as Daniel Flynn points out in his book, the danger of what's happening when we're no longer enlightened, when we're no longer capable of thinking for ourselves. And, you know, we've had some examples in not too far distant history of what happens when mankind stops thinking for itself and relies on someone else or some other body to think for it, and the dangers that all of that brings about. We're talking today about his new book, Blue Collar Intellectuals, When the Enlightened and the Everyman Elevated America. Those days are not that far ago, and I think things can be done to revive those days and to bring it back. But it's going to take an awful lot of work on all of our behalfs. We're going to take a time out, come back to more of our conversation. And as we do so, the phone lines are open for thoughts and comments. Toll free at 888-367-5329, 888-FORKFAX. In particular, are there some intellectual types out there that would agree? My goodness, what's happened? That we've dumbed down society and we've extracted out of popular culture anything that gives a sense of refinement to it, of culture or class to it, where pop culture today, if you spend any time on the internet or watching MTV or anything that masquerades as entertainment on many cable television stations today, it's become an absolute wasteland. It was not always like this. So if we keep that in mind, then the question is, what do we do to revive it so we can get America back on track? Big equation here at a lot of levels, to be sure.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
We're talking with author Daniel Flynn. A look at Blue Collar Intellectuals, When the Enlightened and the Everyman Elevated America. And we're talking about what has become this slow slide down into the abyss. And as you point out in the book, Daniel, as much as we'd like to say, gee, what's wrong with America? Where did we go wrong? There's a degree to which the intellectuals have ultimately failed the culture. They no longer engage the culture the way we once did. You mentioned my friend Milton Friedman, who had been a guest on this program many, many times before his passing, and how much he liked to engage the common man. At what point do you think, where do we see the distinction when that ceased to be the case?
Well, I think with a guy like Friedman, he has a very interesting career, because the first half of it is essentially engaging other intellectuals. And then at a certain point, he goes as far as he's going to go within academia, and he decides to write Capitalism and Freedom, which is for a lay audience and not for an academic audience. He decides to write this Newsweek column, which he writes for 18 years, every 3 weeks. The Free to Choose documentary, he was very skeptical of that because he thought anyone who could be convinced by a half an hour broadcast on television would just be reconverted to the opposite position the next time another half hour program came about, you know, advocating the opposite position. So he was skeptical of some of these things, but he thought that it was his obligation as an economist to engage the educated layperson. I think and Friedman was obviously doing this into the 1990s and really up until his death just a few years ago. There are still people that you see doing this. I mean, that one guy who, you know, I don't necessarily agree with what he does, but I think Ken Burns is someone who you might call a blue-collar intellectual. I mean, he's someone who, you know, people think he's an historian. He's not. He's some guy with a history degree, just like me. You know, he's a history degree from a college, and he decided to make documentaries. And boy, that's a tough thing to make history come alive, to make the dead walk again, essentially. And that's what he does with some of his documentaries, and I really admire that. I may not admire some of his views, but I admire people who at least make the effort to reach the common man. And I don't think that we see that too much with academia, with people who are sort of off in their insular world talking amongst themselves. I think they would be better served if they talked to, you know, if they got out of their intellectual ghettos and talked to the everyman. And I think the everyman would be better served as well. It would be a win-win for everyone.
A big part of this is the kind of the isolation into the ivory tower, so to speak. But then, too, something else that I made reference to Daniel before the break, and that is what I've identified as a major shift, where at one time the principal component in education was to teach students, whether we're talking about K through 12 or at the higher degree levels, how to think. Yes, certainly there were attempts at influencing. There was no doubt about that. I think that we can see, you know, an agenda of one sort or another woven through lots of periods of history, certainly in 20th and 21st century history, to be sure. But all of a sudden, we saw this major shift in education, particularly in the late 50s and early 1960s, where it was no longer about teaching the students what to think, giving them the tools so they could draw their own conclusions, but rather we kind of skipped over that process, and now we just gave them what to think. We went from how to think to what to think.
Yeah, one of the blue-collar intellectuals that I write about is Mortimer Adler, and he was really the evangelist behind the Great Books movement. And one of the reasons why Adler was so successful with the Great Books and selling them is because there was a void that the Harvard and some of the other leading institutions really stopped teaching. Those cultural common denominators, those great books of the Western world.
So this was like when they published, in fact, I've got a whole set at home, like the Harvard Classics?
Strangely enough, Charles Eliot, who was the guy behind the Harvard Classics, one of the reasons that was successful as well is because Eliot had basically created that void by getting rid of the classics in the curriculum at Harvard. So there's an irony there. And with a guy like Adler, whose background is really amazing in the sense that he's probably the only Ivy League PhD I know who had not gotten a high school diploma nor a college diploma before getting his PhD. But the amazing thing for me is not really his academic accomplishments, but his accomplishments as a salesman, in the sense that you can go door-to-door and sell someone a vacuum cleaner, you can go door-to-door and sell someone flatware. But the idea of going door-to-door and selling everyday Americans a million sets of the 54-volume Great Books of the Western World, that to me is absolutely amazing. And Mortimer Adler helped do that at mid-century in America. And here's his big point to get to your question. His big point was, you know, if you just have a monarchy, if you just have one king, you know, there's that phrase, the education fit for a king, and all you have to be concerned about is one guy's education, and your government's fine. But what happens when your king is essentially 311 million people? You have to, you know, that idea, the education fit for a king, you've got to apply that to 311 million people. And if you don't concern yourself with everyone's education, you're going to have a citizenry that's not only not fit to govern the country, but they're really not fit to govern their own souls. And that's the problem as Adler saw it, and that's why he was such an enthusiast of Aristotle and Plato and Shakespeare and all of those great books that used to be the cultural common denominators and now often are left out of the curriculum entirely.
Well, and let's face it, we can just simply sit down and look at the headline news today, and we see the results of this. You know, what happens? Well, you end up with a monetary, a moral, a social, and a spiritual deficit at every level. You know, in economic terms, that's what leads to a $16.4 trillion deficit that nobody can quite explain. In moral terms or spiritual terms, this is what leads to people acting out in unbelievable ways, kind of the personification of man's ultimate, cruelty to man, and no sense of guidelines or respect for others, for life, for any of it. So I think we're seeing the product of it.
Yeah, and can I add, in cultural terms, we just went through 2011, and this is the first year in the history of Hollywood, just to throw something out there that I think every listener can relate to, the first time in the history of Hollywood that the top 10 best-selling movies at the box office in a year were all either remakes, sequels, or based on old comic book characters from 50 or 60 years ago. In other words, there's a complete dearth of originality in the entertainment that we have, in the sense that we're watching the Fast and the Furious Part 5 and, you know, the Hangover Part 2, and that's what people are buying. And it, to me, it just speaks to the fact that as a culture, we're living off the fumes of an America from 50, 60 years ago. And you could probably say the same thing economically and translate that into other areas beyond the culture as well.
I think that, you know, as much as we probably don't want to use what's selling at the box office as a measuring stick, as a yardstick of what's going on in popular culture and society today, I think it's oftentimes a very accurate one. And you're right. I mean, there seems to be this major creative deficit going on, and where what things that do seem to strike a chord are rehashing of films that sometimes have their genesis going back 20, 30, 40 years or more. We're going to take a brief time out. When we come back, I want to talk too about what seems to be the disappearance of the warning system, the early warning system that America had in place. Now, to be sure, thank goodness there are people like Daniel Flynn and others that are trying to fill the gap, but whatever happened to the Aldous Huxleys of the world and the Ray Bradburys and the Orwells of the world, who wrote books warning of what happens to a society when you forfeit your intellectual rights, your moral rights, your spiritual rights, your right of self-governance. We'll get back to more of our conversation. A look at blue-collar intellectuals when the enlightened and the everyman elevated America. Back to our conversation with best-selling author Daniel Flynn as this edition of Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Back to our conversation, best-selling author Daniel Flynn, the book Blue Collar Intellectuals. By the way, you can get a copy of the book at bookstores and, of course, information, too, on his daily blog at flynnfiles.com. Daniel, what of the notion that we've also attended to lost kind of the early warning system? You know, I grew up on the writings of the likes of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. I mean, everybody remembers him for his work on Star Trek, and yet the prolific writing that he did, the warning that's contained in Fahrenheit 451, George Orwell's 1984. I mean, so many aspects of any of these three books and others like them that have served is kind of the early warning sign, and it seems as if a lot of that has kind of disappeared today. We live all today in the moment, and we don't think much about tomorrow, do we?
Well, there's an interesting tidbit in my book relating to both 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. There was a prep school in my home state of Massachusetts. They charged $40,000 a year for students to attend. And a couple of years ago, they decided to get rid of all of their books in their library. The headmaster said, people are acting like this is, you know, 1984. It's not. And I thought, you know, it's not just 1984. It's Fahrenheit 451. And instead of spending the money on books, they decided to spend $50,000 or more than $50,000 revamping the library, adding three flat-screen televisions to what once was a library, and a cappuccino machine. So that's the brave new world. To sort of complete your trifecta there that we're entering into. I think of a guy like Bradbury, and, you know, when he was a kid, he had a lot going against him when he was growing up in L.A. He was extremely poor, so poor that he had to sleep in the same bed with his brother up until the time he was an adult. It was a pull-out couch in their living room. And the other thing he had going against him was he was like a nerd. He used to corner Marlena Dietrich and Clark Gable and Judy Garland for autographs on his roller skates around Hollywood. He was really a terror. The one thing he had going for him is that he was super smart, Ray Bradbury. And so when it came time to go to college, he couldn't go. In the Depression, you know, they didn't have any money. And so what he did instead was he went to the public library for 3 days a week, and he read and he read and he read. And he did this for 4 years, 3 days a week, in lieu of going to college. And I think that a guy like Bradbury, he had it right. In other words, today, these days, people go to college and all they care about is that piece of paper at the end of 4 years. They could care less about the education that comes in between. Bradbury, all he cared about was the education. He could have cared less about that piece of paper. And I think his life gives us a little bit of a lesson to see how our priorities are a little bit screwed up today, where people go to college for the credentialism, for job training, but they don't go for the learning.
Well, they go in order to get the paper, to get the degree, to earn a higher salary so they can keep up with the Joneses, and yet there's very little. And there are certainly always exceptions to this rule, but there is not as much emphasis by any means as there used to be about getting your degree and then going out and doing something to change the world.
That's right. And you know, I'm not. I don't want to make this into a big tirade against higher education. But there are, you know, the blue-collar intellectuals that I write about. I mean, there's a guy like Milton Friedman, who obviously had a huge benefit from being at the University of Chicago, their economics department. But there's someone like Eric Hoffer, who in San Francisco was by day loading, cargo off the docks of ships in San Francisco.
He was a longshoreman, wasn't he? Wasn't he a longshoreman?
He was a longshoreman, and the point here is that he never went to school for a day in his life, and yet, you know, by day he's doing this longshoreman work, and by night in his off hours, he's writing what became The True Believer, which really became one of the best books in the 20th century to understand in the 20th century, and because of the fact that there was this American general in stationed France who read his book in 1951 and then came back to the United States and became president. He was elected president the next year. I'm talking about Dwight Eisenhower, who loved Hoffer's book, and because everyone wants to read what the president's reading, Hoffer became a big celebrity, and all of a sudden the intellectual that all of America wants to consult is a guy who's never been to school a day in his life.
Why do you think then we've seen this shift at the intellectual level where the desire to foster an educated and cultured society just seems to have fallen by the wayside?
Boy, when you hear intellectuals talk, they speak in a jargon that I don't even think they understand. They write books that nobody reads. They speak at conferences that nobody attends. It's almost as if they're trying to convey their apartness from the rest of society. They're not really trying to convey any substantive idea per se, but they're trying to convey how they're in this educated clique, how they're kind of above everyone else. And to me, I mean, that may be cathartic. It may make them feel good, but I don't know what it does. You know, it certainly doesn't do anything for society. And, you know, that's part of the reason I wrote this book, Blue Collar Intellectuals, because here are intellectuals who engaged the public and who spoke to the public and, you know, who may have had their own intellectual work with, you know, involving strictly other intellectuals, but who at least made an effort to uplift the masses from which they sprang. And I think nowadays, because a lot of the people who are in academia certainly don't come from the kind of place that Ray Bradbury or an Eric Hoffer came from, they have absolutely no interest of taking that on.
So rather than having kind of come up through the system, so to speak, they began as a member of the elite. That's all that they've known. And so they kind of hover in that rarefied air with no interest whatsoever of their feet ever touching ground.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. And, I'm married to an academic, so I don't want to bash them too much or I'll get kicked out of my house.
You'll be sleeping with the dog tonight otherwise.
Yeah, but you know, there was something great going on in America for much of the last century, where you had these guys like Will and Ariel Durant and Ray Bradbury and Milton Friedman and all the people that I write about who were making an effort to engage the everyman. And of course, that's kind of what talk radio does. But you don't see that as much from academics or scholars or intellectuals anymore. And that's kind of why I wrote the book, is hoping to jumpstart that again.
How do we do that, then? A closing thought from you, if we can, Daniel, in a minute or so that we have left. How do we get it jumpstarted once again?
Well, I think everyone in their own life, you know, I don't think this is the type of book that people are going to read and say, oh, well, let's pass this piece of legislation, or aha, you know, this is what we do to make everything right. It's not one of those books, but what it is I think anyone who reads it can make those changes in their own lives. They can shut off the television for a day or shut off the internet for a day and pick up a book. You mentioned jokingly in coming into the segment, you know, if bookstores exist. I mean, I used to say you could buy it at Barnes & Noble and Borders, but there's no more Borders. And it doesn't seem to me too many use bookstores anymore. And I think if just people look at the common denominator, how people have lifted themselves up intellectually over the course of the last 400 years or so, the common denominator there is the book. And I think people really got to get back into reading and not so much being in front of screens, whether it's your cell phone or your computer or your television.
Well, and moreover, I think it's important to underscore the fact, Daniel, that this is not just for the matter of you know, lifting the common denominator and sparing the culture from further demise and returning once again a sense of poise and culture and class to a pop culture. At certain levels, this also gets to the heart of of the very protection of otherwise the ultimate demise, I think, of our society and our nation. Because if we don't have in stock and trade at the very least, our intellectual capabilities, there's not much that we have left.
Yeah, and that's, I think, why Adler was doing the great books of the Western world, because society was being torn asunder because we no longer had these cultural common denominators. And he said, look, these are the great books that have united us as a culture. Let's get back into them. Even if, when he was on the cover of Time magazine, the subheadline said, should professors commit suicide? And that was in jest, of course, but there was a grain of truth to it in the sense that he was offering education without the middleman, knocking the middleman out, and basically saying education is a lifetime responsibility. It's not something you do exclusively in schools. It's something you do over the course of your life. And I think if people look at it from that perspective, they may be a little bit more healthy.
One final question I got to squeeze in here. You talk in the book about apostate historians. Elaborate on that for a moment, would you, Daniel?
Yeah, sure. Will and Ariel Durant. I mean, Will Durant, to me, he was the apostate historian. Everything he did, when he was in the seminary, and then he decided one day he was an atheist, he got not only kicked out of the seminary, not only to leave the seminary, but he got excommunicated from the Catholic Church. When he became an anarchist, he was an anarchist teacher. He fell in love with one of his students who was 15 years old, and he was 27. He got married at the city hall. She went to the marriage ceremony with her roller skates. He was always doing things against the grain. When he was an anarchist, or later a socialist, went to the Soviet Union, everyone expected him to come back with all these tales of heaven on earth. But instead, he said, this place is a gigantic prison. And so everything that he did in life, he always was doing the opposite of what was expected of him. And, of course, his marriage ends up by winning jointly a Pulitzer Prize with his wife. They're married for 68 years. You wouldn't expect that out of someone, a teacher who marries a student.
Amazing. Daniel, we sure appreciate the time and the insights. Great book, Blue Collar Intellectuals, When the Enlightened and the Everyman Elevated America, available on the web through Amazon.com, bookstores, if you can find them, and again, Daniel's blog at FlynnFiles.com. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Lifeline. Thanks so much for being with us. And if there was anything you heard on today's show that you'd like to hear again or share with a friend, grab a copy of the Lifeline podcast. Simply log on to KFAX.com. That's KFAX.com for the Lifeline podcast. Our producer is Wanda Sanchez. I'm Craig Roberts. Till next time round, remember, just don't keep the faith. Get out there and share it and make it a great evening. So long.
Opinions expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily represent the views of the ownership, staff, or management of KFAX. Copyright Salem Communications, all rights reserved.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.